Chapter 8 On Free Trade and Restricted Immigration. 1. It is frequently maintained that free trade is connected with free immigration, as is protectionism with restricted immigration. That is, the claim is made that while it is not impossible that someone might combine protectionism with free immigration or free trade with restricted immigration, these positions are intellectually inconsistent and thus erroneous. Hence, insofar as people seek to avoid errors, they should be the exception rather than the rule. The facts, insofar as they have a bearing on the issue, appear to be consistent with this claim. As the last Republican presidential primaries indicated, for instance, most professed free traders are advocates of relatively free and non-discriminatory immigration policies, while most protectionists are proponents of highly restrictive and selective immigration policies. Appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, I would argue that this thesis and its implicit claim are fundamentally wrong. In particular, I will demonstrate that free trade and restricted immigration are not only perfectly consistent, but even mutually reinforcing policies. That is, it is not the advocates of free trade and restricted immigration who are wrong, but rather the proponents of free trade and free immigration. In taking the intellectual guilt out of the free trade and restricted immigration position and putting it where it actually belongs, I hope to promote a change in current public opinion and facilitate substantial political realignments. 2. Since the days of Ricardo, the case for free trade has been logically unassailable. For the sake of argumentative thoroughness, it would be useful to summarize it briefly. The restatement will be in the form of a reductio ad absurdum of the protectionist thesis, as proposed most recently by Patrick Buchanan. David Ricardo's discussion can be found in his Principles of Political Economy and Taxation. The most brilliant 19th-century defense of free trade and intellectual demolition of all forms of protectionist policies can be found in Frédéric Bastiat's Economic Sophisms. For a modern, abstract and theoretically rigorous treatment of the subject of free trade, see Ludwig von Mises' Human Action, A Treatise on Economics. Buchanan's contrary anti-free trade pronouncements are presented in his The Great Betrayal, How American Sovereignty and Social Justice Are Sacrificed to the Gods of Global Economy. Lest it be thought that protectionist views are restricted to journalistic or political circles, see David S. Landy's The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, who displays views quite similar to Buchanan's. The free trade doctrine, according to Landy's, is a religion, and its proponents, such as William Stanley Jevons, are true believers. Landy's quotes Jevons as stating in 1883 that, quote, "Freedom of trade may be regarded as a fundamental axiom of political economy. We may welcome bona fide investigations into the state of trade and the causes of our present oppression, but we can no more expect to have our opinions on free trade altered by such an investigation than the Mathematical Society would expect to have axioms of Euclid disproved during the investigation of a complex problem." End quote. While he obviously disapproves of Jevons's contention, Landy's, like Buchanan, does not attempt to provide anything resembling a refutation of it. The central argument advanced in favor of protectionism is one of domestic job protection. How can American producers paying their workers $10 per hour possibly compete with Mexican producers paying $1 or less per hour? They cannot, and American jobs will be lost unless import tariffs are imposed to insulate American wages from Mexican competition. Free trade is only possible between countries that have equal wage rates and thus compete on a level playing field. As long as this is not the case, as with the U.S. and Mexico, the playing field must be made level by means of tariffs. As for the consequences of such a policy of domestic job protection, Buchanan and his fellow protectionists claim that it will lead to domestic strength and prosperity, and in support of this claim, examples are cited of free trade countries that lost their once preeminent international economic position, such as 19th-century England, and of protectionist countries which gained such preeminence, such as 19th-century America. This or any other alleged empirical proof of the protectionist thesis must be rejected out of hand as containing a post hoc, ergo propter hoc fallacy. The inference drawn from historical data is no more convincing than if one were to conclude from the observation that rich people consume more than poor people, that it must be consumption that makes a person rich. Indeed, protectionists such as Buchanan characteristically fail to understand what is actually involved in defending their thesis. Any argument in favor of international protectionism rather than free trade is simultaneously an argument in favor of interregional and interlocal protectionism. Just as different wage rates exist between the United States and Mexico, Haiti, or China, for instance, such differences also exist between New York and Alabama, or between Manhattan, the Bronx, and Harlem. Thus, if it were true that international protectionism could make an entire nation prosperous and strong, it must also be true that interregional and interlocal protectionism could make regions and localities prosperous and strong. In fact, one may even go one step further. If the protectionist argument were right, it would amount to an indictment of all trade and a defense of the thesis that everyone would be the most prosperous and strongest if he never traded with anyone else and remained in self-sufficient isolation. Certainly, in this case, no one would ever lose his job, and unemployment due to unfair competition would be reduced to zero. In thus deducing the ultimate implication of the protectionist argument, its complete absurdity is revealed, for such a full employment society would not be prosperous and strong. It would be composed of people who, despite working from dawn to dusk, would be condemned to poverty and destitution or death from starvation. In Power and Market, Murray N. Rothbard has offered his reductio ad absurdum of the protectionist thesis. Quote, suppose that Jones has a farm, Jones Acres, and Smith works for him. Having become steeped in pro-tariff ideas, Jones exhorts Smith to buy Jones. Keep the money in Jones Acres. Don't be exploited by the flood of products from the cheap labor of foreigners outside of Jones Acres. And similar maxims become the watchword of the two men. To make sure that their aim is accomplished, Jones levies 1,000% tariff on the imports of all goods and services from abroad, that is, from outside the farm. As a result, Jones and Smith see their leisure or problem of unemployment disappear as they work from dawn to dusk, trying to eke out the production of all the goods they desire. Many they cannot raise at all, others they can, given centuries of effort. It is true that they reap the promise of the protectionists, self-sufficiency, although this sufficiency is bare substance instead of a comfortable standard of living. Money is kept at home, and they can pay each other very high nominal wages and prices, but the men find that the real value of their wages in terms of goods plummets drastically. End quote. International protectionism, while obviously less destructive than a policy of interpersonal or interregional protectionism, would have precisely the same effect and be a recipe for America's further economic decline. To be sure, some American jobs and industries would be saved, but such savings would come at a price. The standard of living and the real income of the American consumers of foreign products would be forcibly reduced. The cost to all United States producers who use the protected industry's products as their own input factors would be raised, and they would be rendered less competitive internationally. Moreover, what could foreigners do with the money they earned from their U.S. imports? They could either buy American goods, or they could leave it in the U.S. and invest it, and if their imports were stopped or reduced, they would buy fewer American goods or invest smaller amounts. Hence, as a result of saving a few inefficient American jobs, a far greater number of efficient American jobs would be destroyed or never come into existence. See further in this, Murray and Rothbard, The Dangerous Nonsense of Protectionism. What the proponents of fair trade typically leave unanswered, Rothbard here points out, is why U.S. wage rates are higher than in Mexico or Taiwan in the first place. Quote, if the American wage is twice that of the Taiwanese, it is because the American laborer is more heavily capitalized, is equipped with more and better tools, and is therefore, on the average, twice as productive. In a sense, I suppose it is not fair for the American worker to make more than the Taiwanese, not because of his personal qualities, but because savers and investors have supplied him with more tools. But a wage rate is determined not just by personal quality, but also by relative scarcity. And in the United States, the worker is far scarcer compared to capital than he is in Taiwan. Putting it in another way, the fact that American wage rates are on the average twice that of the Taiwanese does not make the cost of labor in the U.S. twice that of Taiwan. Since the U.S. labor is twice as productive, this means that the double wage rate in the U.S. is offset by the double productivity, so that the cost of labor per unit product in the U.S. and Taiwan tends, on the average, to be the same. One of the major protectionist fallacies is to confuse the price of labor, wage rate, with its cost, which also depends on its relative productivity. Thus, the problem faced by American employers is not really with the cheap labor in Taiwan, because expensive labor in the U.S. is precisely the result of the bidding for scarce labor by U.S. employers. The problem faced by less efficient U.S. textile or auto firms is not so much cheap labor in Taiwan or Japan, but the fact that other U.S. industries are efficient enough to afford it because they bid wages that high in the first place. So, by imposing protective tariffs and quotas to save, bail out, and keep in place less efficient U.S. textile or auto or microchip firms, the protectionists are not only injuring the American consumer, they are also harming efficient U.S. firms and industries which are prevented from employing resources now locked into incompetent firms and who would otherwise be able to expand and sell their efficient products at home and abroad. End quote. Thus, it is nonsense to claim that England lost its former preeminence because of its free trade policies. It lost its position despite its free trade policy and because of the socialist policies which took hold in England during the last third of the 19th century. Likewise, it is nonsense to claim that the rise of the United States to economic preeminence in the course of the 19th century was due to its protectionist policies. The United States attained this position despite its protectionism and because of its unrivaled internal laissez-faire policies. Indeed, America's current economic decline, which Buchanan would want to halt and reverse, is not the result of her alleged free trade policies, but of the circumstance that America, in the course of the 20th century, gradually adopted the same socialist policies that had ruined England earlier. 3. Given the case for free trade, we will now develop the case for immigration restrictions to be combined with free trade policies. More specifically, we will build a successively stronger case for immigration restrictions, from the initial weak claim that free trade and immigration restrictions can be combined and do not exclude each other, to the final strong claim that the principle underlying free trade actually requires such restrictions. From the outset, it must be emphasized that not even the most restrictive immigration policy or the most exclusive form of segregationism has anything to do with the rejection of free trade and the adoption of protectionism. From the fact that one does not want to associate with or live in a neighborhood of Germans, Haitians, Chinese, Koreans, Mexicans, Muslims, Hindus, Catholics, etc., it does not follow that one does not want to trade with them from a distance. Moreover, even if it were the case that one's real income would rise as a result of immigration, it does not follow that immigration must be considered good, for material wealth is not the only thing that matters. Rather, what constitutes welfare and wealth is subjective, and one might prefer lower material living standards and a greater distance from certain other people over higher material living standards and a smaller distance. It is precisely the absolute voluntariness of human association and separation, the absence of any form of forced integration, which makes peaceful relationships, free trade between racially, ethnically, linguistically, religiously, or culturally distinct people possible. The relationship between trade and migration is one of elastic substitutability rather than rigid exclusivity. The more, less you have of one, the less, more you need of the other. Other things being equal, businesses move to low-wage areas and labor moves to high-wage areas, thus affecting a tendency toward the equalization of wage rates for the same kind of labor, as well as the optimal localization of capital. With political borders separating high from low-wage areas, and with national, nationwide trade and immigration policies in effect, these normal tendencies of immigration and capital export are weakened with free trade and strengthened with protectionism. As long as Mexican products, the products of a low-wage area, can freely enter a high-wage area such as the United States, the incentive for Mexican people to move to the United States is reduced. In contrast, if Mexican products are prevented from entering the American market, the attraction for Mexican workers to move to the United States is increased. Similarly, when United States producers are free to buy from and sell to Mexican producers and consumers, capital exports from the United States to Mexico will be reduced. However, when United States producers are prevented from doing so, the attraction of movie production from the United States to Mexico is increased. Similarly, as the foreign trade policy of the United States affects immigration, so does its domestic trade policy. Domestic free trade is what is typically referred to as laissez-faire capitalism. In other words, the national government follows a policy of non-interference with the voluntary transactions between domestic parties, citizens, regarding their private property. The government's policy is one of helping to protect its citizens and their private property from domestic aggression, damage, or fraud, exactly as in the case of foreign trade and aggression. If the United States followed strict domestic free trade policies, immigration from low-wage regions, such as Mexico, would be reduced, while when it pursues social welfare policies, immigration from low-wage areas is more attractive. 4. To the extent that a high-wage area, such as the United States, engages in unrestricted free trade, internationally as well as domestically, the immigration pressure from low-wage countries will be kept low or reduced, and hence the question as to what to do about immigration will be less urgent. On the other hand, insofar as the United States engages in protectionist policies against the products of low-wage areas' products and in welfare policies at home, immigration pressure will be kept high or even raised, and the immigration question will assume great importance in public debate. Obviously, the world's major high-wage regions, North America and Western Europe, are presently in this latter situation in which immigration has become an increasingly urgent public concern. In order to put matters into proper perspective, it might be useful to supply some brief comments on these regions' free trade and domestic welfare records. These remarks concern in particular the situation in the United States, but they apply by and large to the situation in Western Europe too. Free trade means to impose neither import tariffs or quotas, nor to subsidize the exportation of goods or engage in any other export promotion schemes. In particular, free trade does not require any bilateral or multilateral agreements or treaties. Instead, free trade policies can be implemented instantaneously and unilaterally, and intergovernmental trade agreements, regardless of what they are called, must invariably be regarded as indicators of international trade restrictions rather than free trade. In light of this, the free trade record of the United States must be considered dismal. A labyrinthine system of tariffs and regulations restricts the free importation of literally thousands of foreign goods, from raw materials to agricultural products, machine tools and high technology products. At the same time, the U.S. government engages in a wide variety of export promotion schemes, ranging from simple export subsidies and foreign aid requiring the purchase of certain U.S. goods to massive financial bailouts of U.S. investors in foreign countries and open or concealed military pressure and threat. Moreover, with the so-called North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, a document of about 2,400 pages, when free trade prescriptions can be summarized in two sentences, the U.S. government, in collaboration with the governments of Canada and Mexico, has recently adopted another maze of international trade restrictions and regulations. In effect, NAFTA involves the upward harmonization of the tax and regulation structure across North America, very much like the so-called European Union, EU, does for most of Western Europe. Similar strictures apply to the new creation as the result of GATT's, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, recent Uruguay round of the World Trade Organization. Clearly even more striking is the domestic welfare record of the U.S. and similarly of Western Europe. The record in this regard is not uniform across the U.S. Public welfare assistance is higher in California than in Alabama, for example, which explains significant welfare migration within the U.S. Suffice it to say, however, that U.S. welfare assistance, including cash grants as well as numerous in-kind benefits such as food stamps, housing allowances, Medicaid, aid to dependent children, and public education, etc., can easily reach a household net income of $20,000 per year and rise as high as $40,000 per year. In light of steadily mounting immigration pressure from the world's low-wage regions, three general strategies of dealing with immigration have been proposed. Unconditional free immigration, conditional free immigration, and restrictive immigration. While our main concern will be with the latter two alternatives, a few observations regarding the unconditional free immigration position are appropriate, if only to illustrate the extent of its intellectual bankruptcy and irresponsibility. According to proponents of unconditional free immigration, the United States, qua high-wage area, would invariably benefit from free immigration, hence, it should enact a policy of open borders, regardless of present conditions, that is, even if the United States were entangled in protectionism and domestic welfare. Such a position has been advocated repeatedly, for instance, by the editorial page editors of the highly influential Wall Street Journal, led by the neoconservative Robert Bartley. See, for example, the Wall Street Journal of July 3, 1990, where a constitutional amendment is proposed, "There shall be no borders." Likewise, open border policies have been proposed by Stephen Moore of the Cato Institute, Donald Boudreau of the Foundation for Economic Education, and Jacob Hornberger of the Future of Freedom Foundation. While these individuals and institutions typically refer to Julian L. Simon as their patron saint in this regard, Simon, in fact, does not advocate an open border policy. Far more modestly, Simon recommends instead, quote, "to increase immigration quotas in a series of increments of significant size, perhaps 0.5%, or 1% of total population at each step, to check on any unexpected negative consequences," end quote. More importantly, Simon suggests weeding out those potential immigrants who will become a welfare burden. He recommends discrimination in favor of educated immigrants and those who demonstrate proficiency in English. He suggests giving preference to applicants with financial assets capable of making a direct investment in a host country, and is particularly fond of the idea of selling the right of immigration into the U.S. to the highest bidders. In his last published article, Simon moves still further away from advocating an open-door policy. Surely such a proposal must strike a reasonable person as fantastic. Assume that the United States, or better still Switzerland, declared that there would no longer be any border controls, that anyone who could pay the fare might enter the country, and as a resident, would then be entitled to every normal domestic welfare provision. Is there any doubt about the disastrous outcome of such an experiment in the present world? The United States, and even faster Switzerland, already weakened by protectionism and welfare, would be overrun by millions of third-world immigrants. Two useful figures may indicate the magnitude of the potential problem. For one, according to surveys conducted during the early 1990s in the former Soviet Union, more than 30% of the population, that is close to 100 million people, expressed the desire to emigrate. Second, during the 1990s, the U.S. held an annual diversity lottery, offering visas to persons originating in countries with low rates of immigration to the United States. The 1997 lottery attracted some 3.4 million applicants for 50,000 available visas. Welfare costs would quickly skyrocket, and the strangled economy would disintegrate and collapse, as the subsistence fund, the stock of capital accumulated in and inherited from the past, fathers and forefathers, was plundered. Civilization would vanish from the United States and Switzerland, just as it once did from Greece and Rome. A truly remarkable position is staked out by Walter Block in A Libertarian Case for Free Immigration, Journal of Libertarian Studies 13, No. 2, from 1998. Block does not deny the above predicted consequences of an open border policy. To the contrary, he writes, quote, "Suppose unlimited immigration is made the order of the day, while minimum wages, unions, welfare and a law code soft on criminals are still in place in the host country. Then, it might well be maintained, the host country would be subjected to increased crime, welfareism, and unemployment. An open-door policy would imply not economic freedom, but forced integration with all the dregs of the world with enough money to reach our shores." End quote. Nonetheless, Block then goes on to advocate an open-door policy regardless of these predictable consequences, and he claims that such a stand is required by the principles of libertarian political philosophy. Given Block's undeniable credentials as a leading contemporary theoretician of libertarianism, it is worthwhile explaining where his argument goes astray and why libertarianism requires no such thing as an open-door policy. Block's pro-immigration stand is based on an analogy. Take the case of the bum in the library, he states, quote, "What, if anything, should be done about him? If this is a private library, the law should allow the owner of the library to forcibly evict such a person, if need be, at his own discretion. But what if it is a public library? As such, libraries are akin to an unowned good. Any occupant has as much right to them as any other. If we are in a revolutionary state of war, then the first homesteader may seize control. But if not, as at present, then, given just war considerations, any reasonable interference with public property would be legitimate. One could stink up the library with unwashed body odor, or leave litter around in it, or liberate some books, but one could not plant landmines on the premises to blow up innocent library users." End quote. The fundamental error in this argument, according to which everyone, foreign immigrants no less than domestic bums, has an equal right to domestic public property, is Block's claim that public property is akin to an unowned good. In fact, there exists a fundamental difference between unowned goods and public property. The latter is de facto owned by the tax-paying members of the domestic public. They have financed this property, hence they, in accordance with the amount of taxes paid by individual members, must be regarded as its legitimate owners. Neither the bum, who has presumably paid no taxes, nor any foreigner, who has most definitely not paid any domestic taxes, can thus be assumed to have any rights regarding public property whatsoever. Since unconditional free immigration must be regarded as a prescription for societal suicide, the typical position among free traders is the alternative of conditional free immigration. According to this view, the United States and Switzerland would have to first return to unrestricted free trade and abolish all tax-funded welfare programs, and only then could they open their borders to everyone who wanted to come. In the meantime, while the welfare state is still in place, immigration would be permitted subject to the condition that immigrants are excluded from domestic welfare entitlements. While the error involved in his view is less obvious and the consequences less dramatic than those associated with the unconditional free immigration position, the view is nonetheless erroneous and harmful. To be sure, the immigration pressure on the United States and Switzerland would be reduced if this proposal were followed, but it would not disappear. Indeed, with foreign and domestic free trade policies, wage rates within the United States and Switzerland might further increase relative to those at other locations with less enlightened economic policies. Hence, the attraction of both countries might even increase. In any case, some immigration pressure would remain, so some form of immigration policy would have to exist. Do the principles underlying free trade imply that this policy must be one of conditional free immigration? No, they do not. There is no analogy between free trade and free immigration and restricted trade and restricted immigration. The phenomena of trade and immigration are different in one fundamental respect, and the meaning of free and restricted in conjunction with both terms is categorically different. People can move and migrate. Goods and services of themselves cannot. Put differently, while someone can migrate from one place to another without anyone else wanting him to do so, goods and services cannot be shipped from place to place unless both sender and receiver agree. Trivial as this distinction may appear, it has momentous consequences, for free in conjunction with trade means trade by invitation of private households and firms only, and restricted trade does not mean protection of households and firms from uninvited goods or services, but invasion and abrogation of the right of private households and firms to extend or deny invitations to their own property. In contrast, free in conjunction with immigration does not mean immigration by invitation of individual households and firms, but unwanted invasion or forced integration, and restricted immigration actually means, or at least can mean, the protection of private households and firms from unwanted invasion and forced integration. Hence, in advocating free trade and restricted immigration, one follows the same principle of requiring an invitation for people as for goods and services. The free trade and free market proponent who adopts the conditional free immigration position is involved in intellectual inconsistency. Free trade and markets mean that private property owners may receive or send goods from and to other owners without government interference. The government stays inactive vis-à-vis the process of foreign and domestic trade because a paying recipient exists for every good or service sent. Hence, every locational change, as the outcome of an agreement between sender and receiver, must be deemed mutually beneficial. The government's sole function is that of maintaining the very trading process by protecting citizen and domestic property. However, with respect to the movement of people, the same government will have to do more to fulfill its protective function than merely permit events to take their own course, because people, unlike products, possess a will and can migrate. Accordingly, population movements, unlike product shipments, are not per se mutually beneficial events, because they are not always, necessarily and invariably, the result of an agreement between a specific receiver and sender. There can be shipments, immigrants, without willing domestic recipients. In this case, immigrants are foreign invaders, and immigration represents an act of invasion. Surely, a government's basic protective function would include the prevention of foreign invasions and the expulsion of foreign invaders. Just as surely, then, in order to do so and subject immigrants to the same requirements as imports of having to be invited by domestic resident, a government cannot rightfully allow the kind of free immigration advocated by most free traders. Just imagine again that the United States and Switzerland threw their borders open to whoever wanted to come, provided only that immigrants be excluded from all welfare entitlements, which would be reserved for United States and Swiss citizens, respectively. Apart from the sociological problem of thereby creating two distinct classes of domestic residents, and thus causing severe social tensions, there's little doubt about the outcome of this experiment in the present world. Note that even if immigrants were excluded from all tax-funded welfare entitlements, as well as the democratic right to vote, they would still be protected and covered by all currently existing anti-discrimination affirmative action laws, which would prevent domestic residents from arbitrarily excluding them from employment, housing, and any other form of public accommodation. The result would be less dramatic and less immediate than under the scenario of unconditional free immigration, but it would also amount to a massive foreign invasion and ultimately lead to the destruction of American and Swiss civilization. Even if no welfare handouts were available to immigrants, this does not mean that they would actually have to work, since even life on and off the public streets and parks in the United States and Switzerland is comfortable as compared to real life in many other areas of the world. Thus, in order to fulfill its primary function as the protector of its citizens and their domestic property, a high-wage area government cannot follow an immigration policy of laissez-passer, but must engage in restrictive measures. 5. From the recognition that proponents of free trade and markets cannot advocate free immigration without being inconsistent and contradicting themselves, and that therefore immigration must logically be restricted, it is but a small step to the further recognition of how it must be restricted. In fact, all high-wage area governments presently restrict immigration in one way or another. Nowhere is immigration free, unconditionally, or conditionally. However, the restrictions imposed on immigration by the United States and by Switzerland, for instance, are quite different. Which restrictions should exist? More precisely, which immigration restrictions is a free trader and free marketeer logically compelled to uphold and promote? The guiding principle of a high-wage area country's immigration policy follows from the insight that to be free in the same sense as trade is free, immigration must be invited. The details follow from the further elucidation and exemplification of the concepts of invitation versus invasion and forced integration. To this end, it is necessary to presuppose, as a conceptual benchmark, the existence of what political philosophers have described as a private property anarchy, anarcho-capitalism, or ordered anarchy. All land is privately owned, including all streets, rivers, airports, and harbors. With respect to some pieces of land, the property title may be unrestricted, that is, the owner is permitted to do whatever he pleases with his property, as long as he does not physically damage the property of others. With respect to other territories, the property title may be more or less restricted. As is currently the case in some housing developments, the owner may be bound by contractual limitations on what he can do with his property, restrictive covenants, voluntary zoning, which might include residential rather than commercial use, no buildings more than 4 stories high, no sale or rent to unmarried couples, smokers, or Germans, for instance. Clearly, in this kind of society, there is no such thing as freedom of immigration or an immigrant's right of way. Rather, there exists the freedom of many independent private property owners to admit or exclude others from their own property in accordance with their own restricted or unrestricted property titles. Admission to some territories might be easy, while to others it might be nearly impossible. Moreover, admission to the property of one party does not imply the freedom to move around unless other property owners have agreed to such movements. There will be as much immigration or non-immigration, inclusivity or exclusivity, desegregation or segregation, non-discrimination or discrimination, as individual owners or associations of individual owners desire. If every piece of land in a country were owned by some person, group, or corporation, elaborate Murray and Rothbard, quote, this would mean that no immigrant could enter there unless invited to enter and allowed to rent or purchase property. A totally privatized country would be as closed as the particular inhabitants and property owners desire. It seems clear, then, that the regime of open borders that exists de facto in the U.S. really amounts to a compulsory opening by the central state, the state in charge of all streets and public land areas, and does not genuinely reflect the wishes of the proprietors. Under total privatization, many local conflicts and externality problems, not merely the immigration problem, would be neatly settled. With every locale and neighborhood owned by private firms, corporations, or contractual communities, a true diversity would reign, according to the preferences of each community. Some neighborhoods would be ethnically or economically diverse, while others would be ethnically or economically homogeneous. Some localities would permit pornography or prostitution or drugs or abortion, while others would prohibit any or all of them. The prohibitions would not be state-imposed, but would simply be requirements for residents or for use of some person's or community's land area. While statists, who have the itch to impose their values on everyone else, would be disappointed, every group or interest would at least have the satisfaction of living in neighborhoods of people who share its values and preferences. While neighborhood ownership would not provide utopia or a panacea for all conflicts, it would at least provide a second-best solution that most people might be willing to live with. End quote. The reason for citing the model of an anarcho-capitalist society is that no such thing as forced integration, uninvited migration, is possible, permitted, within its framework. Under this scenario, no difference between the physical movement of goods and the migration of people exists. Just as every product movement reflects an underlying agreement between sender and receiver, so are all movements of immigrants into and within an anarcho-capitalist society the result of an agreement between the immigrant and one or a series of receiving domestic property owners. Hence, Even if the anarcho-capitalist model is ultimately rejected, and if for realism's sake the existence of a government and of public, in addition to private goods and property, is assumed, it brings into clear focus what a government's immigration policy would have to be if and insofar as this government derived its legitimacy from the sovereignty of the people and was viewed as the outgrowth of an agreement or social contract, as is presumably the case with all modern post-monarchical governments, of course. Surely, such a popular government, which assumed as its primary task the protection of its citizens and their property, the production of domestic security, would want to preserve, rather than abolish, this no-forced integration feature of anarcho-capitalism. In order to clarify what this implies, it is necessary to explain how an anarcho-capitalist society is altered by the introduction of a government and how this affects the immigration problem. Since there is no government in an anarcho-capitalist society, there is no clear-cut distinction between inlanders, domestic citizens, and foreigners. This distinction appears only with the establishment of a government. The territory over which a government's power extends then becomes inland, and everyone residing outside of this territory becomes a foreigner. State borders and passports, as distinct from private property borders and titles to property, come into existence, and immigration takes on a new meaning. Immigration becomes immigration by foreigners across state borders, and the decision as to whether or not a person should be admitted no longer rests exclusively with private property owners or associations of such owners, but ultimately with the government qua domestic security producer monopolist. Now, if the government excludes a person while a domestic resident exists who wants to admit this very person onto his property, the result is forced exclusion. And if the government admits a person while no domestic resident exists who wants to have this person on his property, the result is forced integration. Moreover, hand in hand with the institution of a government comes the institution of public property and goods, that is, of property and goods owned collectively by all domestic residents and controlled and administered by the government. The larger or smaller the amount of public government ownership, the greater or smaller will be the potential problem of forced integration. Consider a socialist society like the former Soviet Union or East Germany, for example. All factors of production, capital goods, including all land and natural resources, are publicly owned. Accordingly, if the government admits an uninvited immigrant, it admits him to any place within the country, for without private land ownership, there are no limitations on his internal migrations other than those decreed by government. Under socialism, therefore, forced integration can be spread everywhere and thereby immensely intensified. In fact, in the Soviet Union and East Germany, for instance, the government could quarter a stranger in someone else's private house or apartment. This measure, and the resulting high-powered forced integration, was justified on the grounds of the fact that all private houses rested on public land. By the same token, under socialism, every form of internal migration was subject to government control. Socialist countries are not high-wage areas, of course. Or if they are, they will not remain so for long. Their problem is not immigration, but emigration pressure. The Soviet Union and East Germany prohibited emigration and killed people for trying to leave the country. However, the problem of the extension and intensification of forced integration persists outside of socialism. To be sure, in non-socialist countries such as the United States, Switzerland, and the Federal Republic of Germany, which are favored immigration destinations, a government-admitted immigrant could not move just anywhere. His freedom of movement would be severely restricted by the extent of private property and private land ownership in particular. Yet by proceeding on public roads or with public means of transportation, and by staying on public land and in public parks and buildings, an immigrant can cross every domestic resident's path and move into virtually any neighborhood. The smaller the quantity of public property, the less likely this will occur, but as long as any public property exists, it cannot be entirely avoided. 6. A popular government that wants to safeguard its citizens and their domestic property from forced integration and foreign invaders has two methods of doing so, a corrective and a preventative one. The corrective method is designed to ameliorate the effects of forced integration once the event has taken place and the invaders are there. As indicated, to achieve this goal, the government must reduce the quantity of public property and expand that of private property as much as possible. And whatever the ratio of private to public property may be, the government should help rather than hinder the enforcement of a private property owner's right to admit and exclude others from his property. If virtually all property is owned privately, and the government assists in enforcing private ownership rights, the uninvited immigrants, even if they successfully crossed the border and entered the country, would not likely get much further. The more completely this corrective measure is carried out, the higher the degree of private ownership, the smaller will be the need for protective measures such as border defense. The cost of protection against foreign invaders along the United States-Mexico border, for instance, is comparatively high because, for long stretches, no private property exists on the U.S. side. However, even if the cost of border protection were lowered by means of privatization, it would not disappear as long as there are substantial income and wage differentials between high and low-wage territories. Hence, in order to fulfill its basic protective function, a high-wage area government must also engage in preventative measures. At all ports of entry and along its borders, the government, as trustee of its citizens, must check all newly arriving persons for an entrance ticket, that is, a valid invitation by a domestic property owner, and anyone not in possession of such a ticket must be expelled at his own expense. Valid invitations are contracts between one or more private domestic recipients, residential or commercial, and the arriving person. Qua contractual admission, the inviting party can only dispose of his own private property. Hence, similar to the scenario of conditional free immigration, the admission implies that the immigrant will be excluded from all publicly funded welfare. On the other hand, it implies that the receiving party must assume legal responsibility for the actions of his invitee for the duration of his stay. The inviter is held liable to the full extent of his property for any crimes by the invitee committed against the person or property of any third party, as parents are held accountable for crimes committed by their offspring as long as these are members of the parental household. This obligation, which implies that inviters will have to carry liability insurance for all of their guests, ends once the invitee has left the country or once another domestic property owner has assumed liability for the person in question by admitting him onto his property. The invitation may be private, personal, or commercial, temporary or permanent, concerning only housing, accommodation, residency, or housing and employment, but there cannot be a valid contract involving only employment and no housing. In the current legal environment, wherein domestic property owners are essentially barred from engaging in any form of discriminatory action, the presence of foreign guest workers would inevitably lead to widespread forced integration. Once admitted, based on an existing employment contract, these workers would then be able to use the courts in order to gain entrance also to housing, schooling, and any other form of public establishment or accommodation. Hence, in order to overcome this problem, employers must be required to offer their guest workers not just employment, but housing, and other things such as shopping, medical, training, or entertainment facilities, that is, the amenities of an entire self-contained factory town. In any case, however, as a contractual relationship, every invitation may be revoked or terminated by the host, and upon termination, the invitee, whether tourist, visiting businessman, or resident alien, will be required to leave the country unless another resident citizen enters into an invitation contract with him. The invitee, who is at all times subject to the potential risk of immediate expulsion, may lose his legal status as a non-resident or resident alien only upon acquiring citizenship. In accordance with the objective of making all immigration, like trade, invited contractual, the fundamental requirement for citizenship is the acquisition of property ownership, or more precisely, the ownership of real estate and residential property. In contrast, it would be inconsistent with the very idea of invited migration to award citizenship according to the territorial principle, as in the U.S., whereby a child born to a non-resident or resident alien in a host country automatically acquires U.S. citizenship. In fact, as most other high-wage area governments recognize, such a child should acquire the citizenship of his parents. Granting this child citizenship involves the non-fulfillment of a host country government's basic protective function and actually amounts to an invasive act perpetrated by the government against its own citizenry. Becoming a citizen means acquiring the right to stay in a country permanently, and a permanent invitation cannot be secured by any means other than purchasing residential property from a citizen resident. Only by selling real estate to a foreigner does a citizen indicate that he agrees to a guest's permanent stay, and only if the immigrant has purchased and paid for real estate and residential housing in the host country will he assume a permanent interest in his new country's well-being and prosperity. Moreover, finding a citizen who is willing to sell residential property and who is prepared and able to pay for it, although a necessary requirement for the acquisition of citizenship, may not also be sufficient. If and insofar as the domestic property in question is subject to restrictive covenants, The hurdles to be taken by a prospective citizen may be significantly higher. In Switzerland, for instance, citizenship may require that the sale of residential property to foreigners be ratified by a majority of, or even all of, the directly affected local property owners. 7. Judged by the immigration policy entailed by the objective of protecting one's own citizens from foreign invasion and forced integration, and of rendering all international population movements invited and contractual migrations, the Swiss government does a significantly better job than the United States. It is relatively more difficult to enter Switzerland as an uninvited person, and it is more difficult to stay on as an uninvited alien. In particular, it is far more difficult for a foreigner to acquire citizenship, and the legal distinction between resident citizens and resident aliens is more clearly preserved. These differences notwithstanding, the governments of both Switzerland and the United States are pursuing immigration policies that must be deemed far too permissive. Moreover, the excessive permissiveness of their immigration policies and the resulting exposure of the Swiss and American population to forced integration by foreigners is further aggravated by the fact that the extent of public property in both countries and other high-wage areas is substantial, that tax-funded welfare provisions are high and growing, and foreigners are not excluded, and that, contrary to official pronouncements, even the adherence to free trade policies is anything but perfect. Accordingly, in Switzerland, the United States and most other high-wage areas, popular protests against immigration policies have grown increasingly louder. It has been the purpose of this chapter not only to make the case for the privatization of public property, domestic laissez-faire, and international free trade, but in particular for the adoption of a restrictive immigration policy. By demonstrating that free trade is inconsistent with both unconditionally or conditionally free immigration, and requires instead that migration be subject to the condition of being invited and contractual, it is our hope to contribute to more enlightened future policies in this area.